This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Champions League Spanish show and the championship for Everton, question mark. In Europe's premier competition where for now you still have to qualify, Karim Benzema's brilliance is too much for a disappointing Chelsea. Two stunning headers and a Sunday league catastrophe give Real Madrid a huge advantage. How much will Andres Christensen enjoy coming up against Vinicius Jr. in El Clasico next year? Also, Villarreal dominate Bayern and will be kicking themselves that they only lead 1-0. Gerard Moreno, ably supported by those Premier League nearly men, Danjuma, Lo Celso and Capu, all too much for Julian Nagelsmann's side. In the Premier League, we keep saying that Everton are in trouble, but they really are in trouble. 2-1 up at Burnley and they slip to a 3-2 defeat. Defensive mistakes, a lack of belief in a tough fixture list. You can't win the Everton Cup away at Rotherham, Frank. And it's Ten Hag for Manchester United. Looks like a sensible move. How will they mess this one up? Also today, should mechanical owl Roy Hodgson pick himself in a floating role for Watford? The Keith Stroud Bournemouth conspiracy. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today from the Racing Post, Mark Langdon. Hello.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Archie Rintutt.
Hi, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Jesper says, does this mean that Real Madrid are almost as good as Brentford? Anshiman says, a question for Barry. Benzema's really good, isn't he? Steve says, could Barry have scored either of the Benzema headers? The two headers, Mark, were brilliant. I don't know which one you preferred.
I think I preferred the first one, Max, but they were both, as you say, fantastic goals. Really, really enterprising play from Real Madrid as well, something that we didn't see in that game against Paris Saint-Germain. So it was nice to see them sort of come out and actually allow Benzema those opportunities to score the goals, because in the previous away game they barely got outside of their own half. Benzema spent so long at Real Madrid playing second fiddle to Cristiano Ronaldo, but in a way that was humble, and he did a great job for the team, but there was probably outside of Madrid, maybe a lack of respect for what he was doing, what he was achieving. Not easy being at Real Madrid for such a long time. You look at some of the other players that have gone there and not, Gareth Bale, Eden Hazard, for instance, two real kind of superstar names that have fallen out either with the fans or the press or both. And yet Benzema, even through the difficult times, has always sort of just kept his head down, worked extremely hard for the team. And now in the last couple of years, since Ronaldo sort of left, he's been able to become the star of the team. And I think that first header actually was a remarkable goal. I didn't think it was possible really to get that power from that far out and to beat a goalkeeper as good as Mendy from that distance. I know Mendy then had a bit of a brain failure in the second half, but he shot stopping usually is top notch. And so it was a brilliant performance from Benzema, and he may even have had more goals because he missed probably an easier chance than a couple that he took.
To be fair, Mark, I don't think it's particularly hard to look humble if Cristiano Ronaldo's the guy ahead of you.
Fair point, Archie.
It's a very good point. 24 hours ago, Barry, we were talking about Luis Diaz's beautiful cushioned header to set up Sadio Mane. I actually think the second one, I agree with you. I stood up, Mark, and applauded the first one because it was such a lovely move with Vinicius, and for Benzema to get there and score the header was brilliant. But there's something about the lack of pace on what was a brilliant cross from Modric that he has to kind of twist his neck in this to get any power on that ball, I thought was sort of extraordinary, Baz.
Well, I think he just used the pace of the ball, and there wasn't that much pace on it. It sort of hit the side of his head, like a bit like the ball that Joachim Andersen, his accidental cushioned header for Crystal Palace on Monday night, that led to their first goal. Not that Benzema's goal was an accident, but it's quite funny. I think it was Darren Fletcher was commentating on BT Sport, and he was describing the first goal and said, He described that as a cushion header. I was doing the minute-by-minute report, and I was in the process of describing it as a bullet header. I'm going, hang on a second. What, one of us is wrong. So I dialed it down a bit. And then when the second one went in very soon after the first, Darren Fletcher sort of had to revise his opinion of the first one, because the second one was far more cushioned than the first one. But I'm not having a go at Fletcher at all. They were remarkable, and the contortions he had to, you know, leaning backwards for one of them, the pace, like he's 36 years old, the pace, just to get in position to for the first one in particular, he had to sprint from deep, because I think he started the move as well as finished it. But he's having a remarkable season.
I mean, there are different... Some cushions are quite tough, aren't they? And some are quite soft. So I guess that, you know, if the first... I mean, I agree with you, Barry. The first cushion... The first one wasn't a cushion tender, but it was like a tough, solid cushion. And then the second one was a really soft one that would give you no support.
With recent experience of IKEA, I can agree with you there, Max. Yeah, like, you know, how much... You know, you're right.
Yeah, I'm right.
I also liked... I like the back pedal element to the second one. I think the word that Barry used, their contortion, is right, because, you know, I've just had another look at the first one. I was like, well, how good was that? And then you just see the angle that his neck's at. It's just so unnatural. And the way that he's able to, I think so many players you would see in that position and you'd see that header go so far over the crossbar. And just the accuracy that he's able to get on that. Plus the second one, I think there's something really great about watching goals where the ball goes in at quite a slow speed.
100%.
And there was just something really satisfying seeing it particularly go beyond a goalkeeper who is as tall and lanky as Edouard Mendy. And it's just a very satisfying goal on the eye. And yeah, there's something about... Heide Helgesen used to have a way of taking penalties where he would just roll the ball in. And there's something about that. There is that extra level of coolness to it. I think, yeah, that certainly added something to the aesthetic.
It's impossible to have a conversation with that about Karim Benzema without eventually getting to Heide Helgesen. I know that is always the case. I think one of the beauties of the ball going in so slowly is you can see that the defenders and the goalkeeper know. But you know, they know that there is absolutely nothing they can do about it. It's a bit like when a striker rolls one in, a defender's trying to get there, and all they know is they're going to get stuck in the net at the end or do a Phil Babb. Ale says, why is no one able to make this Real Madrid midfield look old and slow? Like before the coverage yesterday, Mark, we were saying, I'm not sure, Casemiro, Cruz and Modric, they're getting on a bit. This is probably going to be a bit too much for them. And they were all great. I mean, Valverde was brilliant in this game as well, but they were great.
They were great. I think Casemiro does a sterling job there in front of the defence. Tactically, I felt they played really well. And, you know, Kroos and Modric were kind of on the outside of sort of Chelsea's very narrow midfield, and Chelsea could never really get to grips with sort of either of the players. But I think the key point there, Max, was the one you mentioned, that Valverde came in. And although he's not, you know, he's not somebody that you know, necessarily played right in the middle, he is a midfielder that was kind of, you know, helping out, I suppose, in those positions. And that was I think a good move from Ancelotti, who's made some rather bizarre tactical decisions in recent weeks. He was absolutely slaughtered for his Clasico selection, playing sort of Modric as a false nine. And it made sense, I think, to play an extra body in there, because you look at some of the names that, you know, would have probably played in that sort of wider position. Asensio, don't think he would have been the right player for this. Gareth Bale, you know, he's not somebody you can, I don't think, you know, Real Madrid trusts anyway to play in a game of this level, certainly from the start. So I think rather than play somebody that's maybe more natural in that forward position, he sort of sacrificed that, got in an extra person in midfield in Valverde that could also help out Carvajal as well when required. And it worked really well, you know, having that extra body in midfield.
What did you make of Chelsea, Barry? Because I thought that Real Madrid just sort of battered them, especially getting Vinicius getting past Christensen all the time in the first half. And actually, tactically, in the second half, almost like Chelsea made the right changes at halftime, but then they completely ballsed it up 45 seconds into that second half.
It was a poor performance, and Thomas Tuchel was understandably very cross afterwards. But for all that, I thought Chelsea could have done a little better. I mean, they missed some good chances. Mason Mount had a shot that went narrowly over. Lukaku missed a sitter. Aspilicueta had a shot saved by Thibaut Courtois. So they did have chances to reduce the deficit. Ziyech missed a pretty decent chance as well. So for a period in the second half, they weren't terrible, but that balls up just after the break really put them on the back foot when presumably they'd gone out with something resembling fire in their bellies. But it wasn't a particularly good showing from them at all, no.
Thomas Tuchel says the tie is over. Archie, what do you think?
Not yet. I think Real Madrid have shown their vulnerabilities in the past few weeks, whether it was against Barcelona, as Mark was mentioning, or indeed against PSG in that away leg. They looked so limp, I thought. Okay, they do have this difference maker in Karim Benzema, who is in the form of a god right now. But I don't think it's quite over. Away goals rule would have probably made this over, but I think that two goals, it's going to be insanely tough, but not quite over yet. Slightly ajar.
Yeah, I agree with Archie, because if Real Madrid can win 3-1 at Stamford Bridge, why can't Chelsea win by the same score at the Bernabeu? These are two quite evenly matched teams. I think, you know, going into the draw, people maybe even would have felt that Chelsea were a little bit better. So I don't think the tie is all over. I also felt that Militao's injury quite late on, obviously we don't know how bad that is, but he's a very important player for them at the heart of the defence, the replacement Nacho. It, you know, really isn't anywhere near as good as that. So I think that, you know, if he's unable to play, and the way that he went off would suggest it'd be unlikely, or he'd certainly be far from fully fit, given the quick turnaround, I think they would look to sort of, you know, get at that defence. I still think that there are opportunities to do that down the sides as well. I'm not sure that, you know, Carvajal and Mendy are amazing. So it's definitely not all over, but Chelsea just need to play much better than what they did, particularly in the first half, but also against Brentford, and probably haven't seen them at their best for a little while now as well, I would suggest.
It's not Carvajal and Mendy that would worry me from a Chelsea perspective. It's how fired up a certain Thibaut Courtois looked to be playing in that game. I mean, he got a reception of sorts going back. And I think just the level that he was at last night, there was that save from Cesar Azpilicueta where he appears from nowhere. It was, I think, as close as you can do to a Superman dive to stop that going into the top corner. That was a world-class save.
Superman dive, you have to go. Oh, he was that hand. It was the top hand.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, true. I mean, ideally, you have to be facing straight ahead. of, and be wearing a cape. So I'm taking this too literally. I apologise.
I think Courtois could be, it's like facing the boss level in terms of he's going to be very, very difficult to get past again.
Villarreal won Bayern Munich 0. Kevin Hatchard made a good point on this, European football expert. Yet another example tonight of why the whole premise of a closed Super League is bullshit. Villarreal are from a tiny town. They've beaten Manchester United, Juventus and Bayern in the last 12 months. Why would you willingly lose stories like that? Barry, they were so good in this game.
Yeah, really, really good, and will feel that they should have won by more. And if you're Villarreal from a town the size of Villarreal, what's the population? About 45,000-50,000 people. And you're coming off the pitch in the first leg of a Champions League final, disappointed with a 1-0 win over Bayern Munich. That's quite something. There's no reason why they can't go to Germany and get a result. Archie will have a better idea of how the second leg will pan out for me. But I think Villarreal are just one of those clubs everyone kind of has a little soft spot for. They're just nice story and punching so high above their weight on a quite consistent basis. And they've got their nice little ceramic stadium with its yellow walls. But yeah, a really, really good performance from them, and one that it speaks volumes that they'll probably wake up this morning and go, we should have done a little better there.
Yeah, and Marino, Mark, was really unlucky, wasn't he, hitting the post, and that effort from the halfway line was so unlucky because he set it out, you know, it's a bit like like Patrick Schick against Scotland in the Euros, right? He set it out in the right way, but just had too much fade or draw. I'm not sure which one it is to use a golfing term on it.
Do you not think he should have passed?
I thought that, but I thought that in hindsight. And I think that if you're faced with that decision, it's like, hang on, I can chip Manuel Neuer from the halfway line. The only person who I can remember who's done that before is Dejan Stankovic, when it was that game Inter against Schalke in the Champions League. Yeah, you're putting yourself in quite the category if you do that. I mean, I'm not sure all of that's gone through Gerard Moreno's head when he's.
Do you think he recalled the Schalke game? That's probably why he didn't put enough on it, because he was like, "What game was that again? I remember that game."
But it was when you had the behind the goal angle, and you're like, "Oh, if he passes this, it's a 1-on-1." But a 1-on-1 against Manuel Neuer, you could argue how much more of a chance is that? Even if he looked pretty shaky last night, there was the disallowed goal from Francis Coquelin as well, where he did not look like the best goalkeeper in the world, as he is always described in Germany. I've been guilty of that before as well. But yeah, he got very lucky there.
I think it's really interesting with Villarreal in the way that they kind of are prepared to take chance on players that have kind of something's gone wrong for them in their career. And it's quite a wise move when you think about it, because a lot of these players would have been successful in the past, which got them moved sort of higher up the footballing pyramid and, you know, were paid a lot of money at one stage. And for whatever reason, it hasn't quite worked out for them. And they're able to kind of give them a second opportunity. And it worked really well for them. And you look at that sort of team, particularly in terms of Premier League, with Foyth and Lo Celso, Capu, Coquelin, Danjuma, I think probably didn't maybe get long enough in English football to show his full talents. Even Rui, the goalkeeper, was at Manchester City for a very brief period. But I think it's, you know, really clever recruitment. Aurier would be another one where they kind of, there is a sort of process in sort of in Moneyball and, you know, going back sort of to the baseball where, Oakland did take chances on players like that. You know, something went wrong, and then you give them another opportunity. And Villarreal obviously can't compete financially for somebody like Lo Celso when he moved on to Tottenham, because they just haven't got that money. But then when it doesn't work out for him in England, they're able to offer him that opportunity again. And he was showing his Argentina form, I think it's fair to say, last night.
I have this image now of Dejan Stankovic sitting in some bar in Belgrade, boring all comers with the story of the time he chipped Manuel Neuer from the halfway line. And, you know, some tourists come in and they're sort of, is that Dejan Stankovic? And all the other regular, oh, Jesus, here we go.
It's not the same in your pub with you and the Munich incident when fans come in, is it? No, good. Archie, Bayern Munich, I thought were really flat in the first half. The second half, from what I know of Bayern Munich, is they like to play this kind of basketball game where they just think, well, we'll have more chances than you. And that was how the second half panned out. But even still, Villarreal had the better chance in that game. Were you surprised at how flat they were?
This wasn't really a surprise. For all three of us who have been watching the Bundesliga this season, I think that the way that Bayern have played is they've not been tested a lot of the time. And even when they have been tested, they've sometimes struggled. And whilst they are deservedly top of the league, and no one can debate that, Bayern have also got issues off the pitch right now in sorting out the contracts of key players like Serge Gnabry, like Robert Lewandowski, like Manuel Neuer. And there's a point, Thomas Müller as well. There's a point where all of that background stuff can start to affect things which are going on the pitch. The thing is, this performance, they didn't have a shot in the first half, Max. Not a shot. And you saw a similar kind of display away at Salzburg a couple of weeks ago as well. This was no real surprise seeing them not really have the intensity to to break down Villarreal. They just hung on for the ball, hung on to the ball a second too long, a millisecond too long around the tight spaces, and gave chances to Raul Albiol, Juan Foyth to get their foot in. Alphonso Davies, in hindsight, we didn't know how fit he was. This is the first game that he started since coming back from his COVID-related injury. And I thought going forward, he didn't look at it. At the back, he saved them multiple occasions, as we're used to seeing. I think a fully fit Alphonso Davies makes a difference. But there just something wasn't quite there. And the thing with Bayern right now, it comes back to those contracts, is they are wary of how much money they are spending, even if they are spending vastly more than any other Bundesliga club, as Borussia Dortmund's CEO is always willing to point out. You're looking at a 150 million euro odd defence there with Benjamin Pavard added into that. And can you tell me that defence is the envy of Europe or the envy of the top sides? I don't think that those defenders would get into the top back fours, back threes of any other top European club right now. Manuel Neuer has been in good form, but that was an off night, and he can have those every now and then.
Just ask Dejan Stankovic,
yeah. So I think it was a reminder for Bayern. Look, being back in Munich is going to be a different proposition. They are going to go, it is going to be backs to the wall for Villarreal, of course, but we've seen what they can do on the counter. They are very dangerous. And this was the first away game that Bayern have lost in the Champions League in 5 years. The last time was against PSG, who were managed by Unai Emery.
It all comes full circle. What a way to end part one. And part two will begin with Everton's defeat at Burnley. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Johnny says, why can't the pod be bothered visiting Liverpool on tour? Ellis James says, play in Wales, you monster. Sean Ingle, who read the small print, said, half and half scarves printed with the faces of Max and Barry. What fresh hell is this? Who in their right minds would buy one of these? I have been in touch, Barry, with the merchandising department to say, it sounds funny on paper, but who's going to buy a half and half scarf with me and your faces on it? But anyway, maybe people will. We don't know. We are doing a UK tour. The dates are set. Go to myticket.co.uk. We are playing Dublin, Leeds, Birmingham, Glasgow, London, and Manchester. They're the ones. It's not written down. I can remember it. But, you know, maybe we'll get more dates already. I don't know. All I know is that Dublin is selling quite well already. Thank you, people in Dublin. Hopefully all the other tickets are sold. I don't know yet. Zach says, why did I, a Midwest US young adult, decide to follow and support Everton of all teams? Is there something wrong with me? Also, please don't mention Everton on the pod. Big fan. Thank you, Max. I'm sorry, Zach. We have to do it. Burnley 3, Everton 2. So many questions. Ian says, who's Frank going to blame tonight? The weather, the M65, Burnley's digital advertising boards. Rob says, we've established that Everton can't do it on a wet Wednesday night in Burnley, but can they do it on a cold Tuesday night in Stoke? We may find out. And Richard says, has anyone got Barry Horn's number to see if he's available to help Everton escape, or perhaps Hans Sager's? What did you make of this game, Baz?
Everton were poor again. They keep making really silly mistakes that are costing them dearly. Burnley's opener, Nathan Collins, completely unmarked at the back post. Everton can't defend set pieces, and he just side-footed a cushioned side foot. We can wax lyrical about them. Cushioned side foot into the goal. The second Burnley goal, James Tarkowski manages to hold off Dominic Calvert-Lewin with an absolute minimum of fuss. Then Charlie Taylor escapes down the left touchline, leaving the increasingly hapless John Joe Kenny trailing in his wake. Pulls the ball back into a crowded penalty area where a completely unmarked Jay Rodriguez roofs it. And the third goal, Charlie Taylor, who was made to look like elite class player, you know, world class last night. His cross clanks off Ben Godfrey's shin, or we charitably call it a slice clearance, whichever, neither is good. And Matty Vidra pulled back into the area where Cornet rifles home. Three easily preventable goals, but Everton couldn't prevent them. You know, they were in the game. It was 2-2. They got two penalties. I thought at least one of them was fairly soft. And Everton have a quite daunting fixture list ahead of them. So while they're still ahead of Burnley, if they keep playing the way they are and keep making the mistakes they are, which they can't seem to iron out, you'd have to say they're probably going to get relegated.
The noise was great here, Mark, when Cornet scored. And so cliche of Sean Dyche to not look bothered. You know, I'm not going to celebrate. Oh, no, that's not Ian Holloway, is he? But anyway, I'm not an impressionist. But like,
I think that was good, Max.
It's a great victory. Thank you, Archie. I appreciate it. it's a brilliant victory for Burnley. But Everton is such a big story here, Mark, because it is kind of unthinkable that they could get relegated. I still think they'll survive somehow. But Barry's right. Their running is really hard.
Running is very difficult. If you're, you know, away from home, you're absolutely terrible. And if you're given, you know, two goals by not having to do that much to get them, as Barry said, they were both, you know, quite soft, and you still lose, conceding three goals to Burnley, who, you know, probably one of the least prolific teams sort of last Premier League in sort of Premier League over the last 5 years or so. I mean, that spells big, you know, problems for Everton. I thought it was an unmissable game. I couldn't take my eyes off of the game. The quality was low, but the excitement was really high. And then it continued after the game when Sean Dyche did these lads, it's Everton halftime speech, which was, and I thought it was really interesting that he mentioned that in his post-match press conference. That seemed to me a deliberate ploy to kind of turn the pressure even more on Everton. You know, you can't win away from home. We all know you can't, even when you're ahead against us. So, you know, Frank Lampard has got, if he didn't already realise, I'm sure he did, he's got an enormous job now to lift the players. I don't think there's anything really better in domestic football than seeing a really big team fighting against relegation. It's one of definitely one of the most exciting things about sort of the end of a campaign, because the fans, they're so angry for about 30 matches of a really disappointing season. And then they realise they've got a really important part to play. They start to back the team and really get behind them for a couple of games. And I think this game on Saturday they've got against Manchester United is absolutely like humongous, because we know Burnley have got Norwich, a big opportunity for them to get ahead over the weekend. If Everton can get a result, and the Goodison crowd have been quite good, I think, in recent games, but against Newcastle seem to carry them over the line. It's at home where Everton are going to stay up. I don't fancy them away from home sort of picking up points anywhere.
You say that. How they start that game is so important, because the nerves of the fans is going to shine through. And once a couple of mistakes start happening, as a fan, I think you lose it after a while. But also with the players, Barry was describing those Burnley goals and how future Ballon d'Or winner Charlie Taylor was running rampant down the left-hand side. But you looked at the way that the Everton players were defending. They looked petrified. They looked petrified in the box and just this, well, I hope someone's going to go to him. Oh, no one's gone to him. And if that is your mentality, you've got big problems. And that Frank Lampard's not been able to instill what I would say is a basic level of relegation threatened team discipline of we must have this structure at least. Where I think to delve into the relegation cliche box, you fear for Everton.
Yeah.
You really do.
You really do.
Burnley and Watford are going to be taking on this relegation battle with, we've got nothing to lose. There is not the same pressure on us as there is on Everton. And that can be quite freeing for them as well. To be honest, for the three teams above the relegation zone, albeit I think it's just Everton now, the way it looks, There's a lot more pressure on the clubs out of the relegation zone right now than the clubs in.
Well, Leeds go to Watford on Saturday, and that's quite a big game for them, because you think if they can win that, they're probably safe. But if they get beaten, they're right back in it. But the thing is, there's no reason why Frank Lampard should know what to do. He's never played for a team that came close to being relegated. He's never managed a team before that came close to being relegated. And a lot of the managers of teams around him have the experience. He doesn't, and sort of know how to go about this, know how to rally the troops. And you just get the impression that Lampard is as hopelessly out of his depth as many of his players seem to be here.
Their transfer window, not just the recruitment of Lampard, which I think was a strange appointment, but you know, they got rid of Luca Digne, right? And then sacked Benitez, which was ridiculous. And then they bring in Van der Beek, you know, an out-of-form player who's not playing at Manchester United, Van der Beek. An out-of-form player who's not playing at Spurs, Dele Alli, who are not roll your sleeves. I mean, this is cliches, but roll your sleeves up, get stuck in. They don't know how to survive a relegation scrap either. You know, I think Anwar El Ghazi came in. I mean, maybe he knows, but he's played like 5 minutes. And you sort of think, that recruitment is insane, right? If you're trying to stay up, I mean, you're better off trying to get Neil Redfern and, you know, Lee Catamol in. Like just some people who can, you know, all those cliches that I think are true about relegation scraps, which are, you know, where are your leaders? Who is there who's just absolutely just going for it?
They also brought in two young fullbacks who were seen as players for the future rather than gnarled old pros who might do a job for them. One of those fullbacks, is it Nathan Patterson, is now out for the season, despite the fact that I don't think he's actually played for them.
No, he was only ruled out, I think, from the moment Lampard said he was about to start him.
Okay, right.
And then he got ruled out for the season.
I mean, John Joe Kenny and Seamus Coleman. Seamus Coleman hasn't played the last couple of games, but they've just looked like competition winners, you know, who've been taken out of the stand and handed jerseys. They're really, really missing Yerry Mina, but he's not there, so you have to get on with it.
Yeah, I mean, Alan says, looking at their running, when will Everton get their next point? And then I saw they were home to Manchester United. I thought, oh, well, probably then. But, you know, home to Manchester United, home to Leicester, who are improving, away to Liverpool, home to Chelsea, away to Leicester, so they play them twice. And that is a really hard 5 games. Look, then they've got Watford, Brentford and Palace, right? Towards the end of the season, you imagine those sides could be, Watford could be already down. Brentford and Palace might be, quote, on the beach. But if you're in a situation, if you don't get any points from the next five, you'd imagine that the teams below them will get some points from the next five. And then you are just, once you're down there and the confidence goes.
But the problem is, Max, so many different players are making mistakes. Like every week, every match, it's a different one. You know, Iwobi makes one. Ben Godfrey does. We've seen Keane make that. It's just like he's moving the players around a little bit, trying different things, but they're just, none of it is working. And then up front, Calvert-Lewin, I don't know if he's not fully fit at the moment, but he doesn't look like the Calvert-Lewin of last season, that's for sure. And you really, their hope is that Richarlison and Gordon really offer something in those wider areas. And, you know, I suppose there is a bit of quality in those two, particularly Richarlison. I think I'd rather be in Burnley's position, even though they're, you know, slightly below them in the table at the moment.
Yeah, and I'm loath to sound like a proper footballing man, but like the timing of Dominic Calvert-Lewin's photo shoot where he's wearing trousers that look like lampshades, you know, I think it was GQ, you know, pages and pages, what that will do to, you know, your sort of dyed-in-the-wool 60-year-old Everton fan. So, you know, of course, footballers can do things in their afternoons. Like, it doesn't matter. It shouldn't make a difference. But the timing is hilarious.
I get it on the one hand, but I think we're way too obsessed with optics.
About this
kind of thing, aren't we? I mean, look, completely different end of the scale, but there was a fashion thing that came out of Benzema mid-game last night. When you're doing as well as Benzema is right now, it's quite easy. But I also think it's too easy a pot shot for us to take against Calvert-Lewin to just say, oh, well, the general conjecture is you should be shutting yourself away in a in solitary confinement and not seeing light for
You can't smile, yeah, actually, in the next 3 days after the visit.
Can't smile, can't go out for a meal. And you can only wear sensible shoes, bootcut jeans, and a T-shirt with a sensible grey pullover.
But this is also the point, actually, is that optics have created Everton's problems. These players signed on, well, he's a good player, without really considering the profile of someone like Ali and Van der Beek for this kind of scrap. And you look, you talked about, Max, an insane transfer policy. Which transfer window of Everton are you referring to? Which of the last few years are you talking about here? Because far too often, even with the coaches that they've signed, and Frank Lampard, for example, that is an optics thing. He's done well on paper, but are you really looking at the experience that he has? Are you looking at the qualities and the characteristics that these players have? I think that too often Everton have gone for something which sounds right instead of doing what is actually right for the club. And you look at someone like Brentford and the way that they take decisions, and it doesn't have to look like the right one. It just needs to be the right one for the club. And more so in football, you see the success of these smaller clubs who are more tightly run. They don't have the same weight of history, that you don't have to fulfill a certain expectation. And I think that that also is one of the things that is weighing Everton down so heavily is, yeah, as we've seen with big clubs getting relegated in the past, like you hear from the near pain, what that's like to play for a big club when you're going under. I mean, you see it in Sunderland Till I Die pretty well. It's a very difficult situation to fight your way out of.
It's but the truth is, we are now at the stage where genuinely they would have more chance of staying up if they brought in Sam Allardyce. You know, that is the truth, isn't it? Mark says, if they go down, would next season's Everton Cup be seventh in the Championship or seventh in the Premier League? Harry says, Everton Cup will be renamed to what? The Wolves Cup? The Southampton Shield? It's very good questions. Big questions that we will have to consider over the course of the summer if they do go down. Just to let you know, the Burnley run-in, Norwich, West Ham away, Southampton, Wolves at home, Watford away. I mean, like, it's just a massive swing in those five games, isn't it? Then Villa at home, Spurs away, Villa away again. So they play Villa in closer, and Newcastle. So like their running is just so much easier. But then, you know, football is a funny game, isn't it? So we'll see what happens. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up any other business, bit of Bundesliga, and anything else we want to discuss. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, die Bundesliga, Archie, as you've corrected me in the break. What are the headlines? Bayern leading the way. Tell us all the interesting things in a short, snappy way, please.
Right, Bayern. Yeah. They are 9 points clear at the top of the table. Could become six again because they had 11 outfield players at the weekend for around 20 seconds. And Freiburg have protested against that. We await to see what a German FA disciplinary hearing will make of that. There's been a lot of hoo-ha about that over here. Not that it really matters, because Borussia Dortmund behind them are not looking capable of being consistent enough in big games. I was at their game against RB Leipzig. They lost 4-1. Same incoherent performance that I've seen on so many occasions. I saw them get absolutely hammered by a Leverkusen just over a month ago. And whilst Mats Hummels, who continues to, between the lines, throw his teammates under the bus with his comments, this is the thing with Borussia Dortmund, is that actually there's almost this level of gaslighting going on from the CEO, Hans-Joachim Watzke, and the way that they talk about the problems, and they not they never actually deal with it. They just talk about the glory days of the relationship, the glory days of when they won the league and how Vatska saved the club in 2005. And that's not a direct argument for actually sorting out the problems. And Mats Hummels is very close to Vatska, for example, and he just doesn't look up to it. And when you are creating the kind of dressing room atmosphere that his comments will be creating, he's not conducive to the way that Borussia Dortmund are pushing along. And yeah, I think he's going to probably get a new deal. So Dortmund are in a place right now where, even though they're second, there's talk of Marco Rosa potentially being sacked at the end of the season. We'll see what happens with that. Meanwhile, do you remember Felix Magath, Max?
Oh, I love Felix Magath, the cheese. Was it Brede Hangeland? Who had the cheese? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's back at Hertha, right?
Hertha, yes, he is. He is there along with Mark Fotheringham, who former Dundee player and Fulham player. I can tell you that he's the only Fulham player I've seen who came on and was subbed off because things were going so badly for him in that game, and there was ironic applause whilst Felix Magath was in charge. And Felix Magath he's brought out the medicine balls. He's got them in the hall, climbing up ropes, pushing gym mats. Let's see if it works. Hertha are back in the bottom two, but they did have a surprising win when Magath wasn't on the touchline against Hoffenheim. And Mark Fotheringham, who's, by the way, fair play to a Scot or anyone from this island of ours to go and be in the public eye and speak in German as he does really quite well.
Disappointed that you branched out from just Scotland there. Yeah. Sort of dig. Scottish people can't learn foreign languages.
A Scottish friend of mine speaks very
some of my best friends are Scottish and they're bilingual.
Derek Gray, you might know him, Bundesliga commentator who speaks exceptional German. So there's that. There's the fact we finally got full stadiums against Mats.
Yeah, and that's been a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, going to the game on Dortmund Leipzig at the weekend, there was like a fan march to the stadium, a couple of thousand fans, led by the ultras. There was one or two incidents I heard of ultras attacking onlookers, and I asked my contact, right, so when you say attacking, it's like, well, the people who were filming them, they were throwing doner kebabs at. I was like, okay.
And their weapon of choice is a kebab? To see Mark utterly furious, what a waste of meat.
It's a waste of a kebab. Why on earth would you waste a kebab like that?
If that's how you want to spend your €5, fair play.
And you're going to Eintracht Frankfurt, Barcelona, aren't you? Both legs of that game. What chance have they got?
Yes, I am very excited for this. So are Eintracht Frankfurt fans. There were 300,000 ticket requests for the game against Barcelona in Frankfurt tonight. There are an expected 30,000 Frankfurt fans to go to Barcelona. How many of them will get in is a different question. I've heard a number of 20,000. And also, the journey that they have to take over there is, as I found out booking my flights over, any flight going from Germany to Barcelona, it now costs you £500, because who would have thought that airlines would try and take advantage in that kind of way? So I think it's an 18-hour drive to Barcelona that many fans are taking on.
Oh, like, fun.
Yeah, it is. Whether Frankfurt can actually lay a glove on this Barcelona team right now is a completely different question. Kevin Trapp, their goalkeeper, is in excellent form, which is promising. Frankfurt have not scored in their last two games, which is less promising. But these European nights that Frankfurt are having, go back to Borussia Dortmund, this is something that they're not having right now. These kind of special European occasions, even if it is in the Europa League. Eintracht Frankfurt had that very near miss against Chelsea in the Europa League semi-final and beating Benfica and Inter a few years ago. And this is... this is the game of the century, as one member of the board at Eintracht described it. It is going to be, I'm buzzing for the atmosphere. I only slept a couple of hours last night, Max, just thinking about it, actually.
That's good. It's good. It's enthusiasm for football. I mean, this maybe perhaps should have been higher up the running order about Ten Hag going to Manchester United. I don't know how done a deal it is, but everyone seems to be suggesting it is going to happen. I wonder, what, Mark, what you make of that?
I mean, he's a good coach. We've seen that, particularly Ajax, but even before that, I think that there were signs that he, you know, was sort of capable of managing at a very high level and coaching players at a high level. But I just saw that somebody maybe they're bringing in another person, Manchester United, into the sort of a deputy director of football as to go with all of the other people that they've got making sort of these decisions. And until they get that part off the pitch right in terms of who makes the signings and the whole clarity off the pitch, I think it's very difficult for any coach to go in there and be successful, because they've had good coaches in the past. Mourinho and Van Gaal possibly on the way down, but still good coaches. And David Moyes, you know, has proven himself at West Ham. Again, maybe not at the level that United would have been, I suppose, believing he could get to, but he's still a good coach that was made to look really bad at United. And when a succession of managers are all made to look the same way, then maybe you feel like it's not the coach or the manager that's the overriding issue. So until they get the off-the-field stuff sorted out, I think it's very difficult. Ten Hag has got Ajax, a much more sort of solid foundation from which he can work with. But I do like the way his teams play football. They have got an identity. I think that's a couple of things that maybe has been an issue for Manchester United in recent years. But then alongside those reports of Ten Hag on his way to Manchester United, you get prepared to spend 150 million on Rice and in excess of 100 million on Kane. And you're just thinking, like, well, who's deciding that? Like, is that Ten Hag? Is that somebody else? I just think that Manchester United's problems run much deeper. And I know we've said this on the pod before, but just run much deeper than the coach. And, you know, he's going to need help off the pitch before I think United can sort of get anywhere close to those sort of top two in England.
Dan says, has there ever been a Fulham game in which Mitrovic hasn't scored? I heard there might have been one back in 1924 against Everton away, but then I checked and in fact he levelled on 60 minutes after Dixie Dean's opener. Fulham all but confirming promotion to the Premier League with a 1-0 win over Middlesbrough, who were battling to get in the playoffs last night. So that is great, Archie. You get your 1 year in the Premier League. You wanted to talk more actually about season tickets going for £1,000. I mean,
yeah,
that seems like quite a lot of money, doesn't it?
It is. It's a bit of a dampener on what's been going on the pitch, even if I'm not mega convinced that Fulham will stay up next season. At least this time I've got an extra month to enjoy promotion rather than last time where it was so quickly into it after beating Brentford in the playoff final that there was such a quick turnaround because of Corona. But yes, in the shiny new Riverside stand that has been built by the Thames, fans are being charged £1,000. And I get that you need to make it commercially viable, but at what cost? At the cost of pricing out your fan base is somebody who pays £1,000 for a season ticket, that game we had last night away at Middlesbrough, you telling me that if we're in a relegation scrap in 4 years' time because we happen to lose our game of parachute payment roulette, are they going to Middlesbrough to fire on the team? I don't think
they've got to go to Middlesbrough and get something.
Right.
Haven't they?
Exactly.
That's what you sounded like. No, you make a good point. I mean, it's too much money for a season ticket, right? I mean, it's just that.
It is. It is. And particularly, it is so out of kilter with what is going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
Like the cost of living crisis that there is in the UK, and you're Fulham and you claim to be this family club, which which is, I mean, just another way of saying middle class, really, isn't it? You're just trying to say that, yeah, you know, this is what we're about. And there's so much good work done by the club in other areas. And then there are these decisions which are taken across the ocean and in America. And I'm like, what are you doing? That it is just so infuriating to see that being done to your club, our club, whatever. When, look, of course it's nothing new, but if anything, and people, I've heard people justify it in terms of being like, well, you know, it's nothing new. That doesn't make it right. If anything, it makes it even worse.
Sure. I mean, I guess it depends. It depends on how, like, if there are 5 season tickets for 1,000 and the rest are 30 quid, it's fine. It's just if most of, you know, if you are pricing people out of going to their
local
club. There
is just no need to charge anyone that amount for a football ticket. Full stop. With the amount of money that is going around in the game right now, there is just no need. And people go, well, would you rather the team spent less? Yes. Yes, I would. If it meant that football is more accessible to fans, then yes. I don't care if we go down with 3 points and we spent zero on transfers. That really doesn't bother me.
I would find it very funny if Fulham only got 3 points in the season.
I'm always very perplexed by fans who will actively defend their club's rinsing tactics of fans just because it's their club. You know, it's like they literally can do no wrong. But maybe Rishi Sunak and his non-dom tax-avoiding wife could buy a pair of those £1,000 tickets. They look like the kind of people who would enjoy being at Fulham. And they'd be able to afford a private jet to that away game at Middlesbrough.
I think, by the way, on that note, I think I'm dom-dom status. As far as I can tell, I'm playing tax in both countries, so I completely screwed it. And now, the shirt in which Diego Maradona scored the Hand of God goal in Mexico 86 up for sale could sell for £4 million at auction, Barry. It's exciting, is it? I mean, that's what I asked in the WhatsApp group. Does Steve Hodge get all the money? Is it Steve Hodge took the shirt off Maradona? It's his shirt, or does it? Is there some kind of thing,
yes.
You know, like when you dig up an old copper coin, it belongs to the government.
Now, I presume Steve Hodge gets it. It's been on long-term loan to the National Football Museum for, I think, the best part of 20 years, but it is very much Steve Hodge's shirt. He asked Maradona for it after the game. Maradona gave it to him. Maradona took Hodge's shirt. I don't think that'll go for $4 million if he's still, or if the Maradona estate still owns it. But interestingly, that shirt, I mean, it isn't even an official Argentina shirt because they went to the 86 World Cup. They had to play Uruguay in a group game, I think, and they had to wear their away colours, inverted commas. So they had these heavy cotton blue shirts, which were far too hot for the weather. So Carlos Bilardo, their manager, sent some minion or lackey out to scour the sports shops of Mexico City to try and find something lighter. So he came back with these blue V-neck shirts. Then they had to get some kid to print off a template of an Argentina badge and get them made and sewed onto the shirts. They needed numbers for the shirts, and the only ones they could get were those sort of silver, glittery numbers that are more commonly associated with American football shirts, and they were ironed on, and that's the shirt Argentina wore. So the shirt itself is probably worth about 20p, but because Maradona wore it in that game, it could go for $4 million or more. So I presume Steve Hodge gets the money after Sotheby's take quite a big cut.
Wasn't the story that he had to hide it from Terry Butcher because Butcher would have been furious at anyone swapping shirts with Maradona after the handball goal. But
And Peter Shilton is still furious. Maybe Shilton will run to Sotheby's and try and set light to the shirt before Steve Hodge can cash in. Johnny says, do you think you'll be able to curl perfect crosses into the box when you're Roy Hodgson's age? Yeah, lovely clip doing the rounds of Hodgson playing a little left foot through ball. I don't even know if he's left footed. Through to who scored the goal? João Pedro, was it?
João Pedro.
Yeah. So, you know, fair play to Roy, isn't it? That was a lovely pass. And also, he didn't like stand there and put his hands in the air. It's like, I do this every day, mate.
Yeah, well, I mean, Modric will be looking at that, thinking maybe he can go on for another 40 years. Why not?
Joel de Haas says, gentlemen, though I agree with you, making fun of the Manx refereeing Manx hysteria about Anthony Taylor and Paul Tierney, I would like to point out the following interesting tidbit. Keith Stroud of Bournemouth has refereed AFC Bournemouth in 13 matches across all competitions. Bournemouth's record over those games reads as follows. Played 13, won 12, drawn 1, lost 0. So yours, Joe de Haas. Isn't that great? Occasionally, Bournemouth go, it's Keith Stroud. We'll be absolutely fine. I seem to remember me and you, Barry, asking listeners on TalkSport about referees' conspiracies. And, you know, there are some really brilliant, you know, Walsall have got one against, I forget who it is, probably Trevor Kettle. But, like, this exists in all the leagues, doesn't it? So good luck to Keith Stroud and all his Bournemouth games. Tim writes, finally, on the subject of pod merchandise. A few years ago, I stumbled across some merchandise on your website, Max, and jokingly said to my brothers that I wanted something from it. But unfortunately, everything was sold out. Yes, it was a joke page. I said I was selling USB sticks and drum kits with my name on it. I wasn't. The page is now defunct, sadly. To my surprise, I unwrapped a tea towel with your face and the glory years on which I think I hope they'd specially made. They had specially made. I'm not marketing the glory years tea towels. Attached is a photo. My fiance hates it. Hope to see you in Leeds for the live show. I'm absolutely delighted, Tim, that has been made. And I took none of the profits and I want none of them too.
You know how, like, before games, Liverpool, everyone holds up their scarf with your Never Walk Alone.
Yeah.
When you're playing the walk-on music for Football Weekly, yeah, he should be standing there with the tea towel in the crowd.
If he really cares, he should go and take it to somewhere that will turn it into a tifo, frankly. You know, a massive one saying the glory years. We all remember
the live tifo.
Yeah.
That'll be amazing.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Archie.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Monday. Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove with Silas Gray, and our executive producer is Max Sons.
This is The Guardian.